They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
In Egypt, celebrations and protests continue. Mohamed Morsi is out and an interim president is in. On the broadcast today, the latest on the turmoil in Egypt and what it means for U.S. companies doing business there. Also on this, the 4th of July, we've got cheap beer and fine wine. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From APM in New York, this is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 4th of July. I'm David Gura in for Kai Rizdahl. Happy Independence Day, everybody. It's great to have you with us. The man who was the Chief Justice of Egypt's Supreme Constitutional Court is now Egypt's interim president. He was sworn in today only hours after the Egyptian military suspended the country's constitution and removed Mohamed Morsi. Morsi has been arrested along with several high-ranking members of his party, the Muslim Brotherhood. Kimberly Adams is a reporter based in Egypt. She joins us on the line now from a coffee shop in Cairo. Hi there, Kimberly.
Hi, David.
Now, yesterday we saw these images of celebrations and protests. There were fireworks and lasers illuminating Tahrir Square, some big crowds there as well. What's been happening there today?
Actually, today those crowds have pretty much thinned out, and most of the protests, at least those that were against President Morsi and calling for Morsi to be kicked out of office, as he eventually was, have pretty much gone home. But what has remained are some of the protests in support of President Mohamed Morsi, and those groups are still gathering and still calling for the reinstatement of the president and that this, what they are calling a military coup, is illegitimate. Meanwhile, the military has actually been going around and detaining several supporters of Morsi and members of his organization, the Muslim Brotherhood.
That word, a coup, is a word the Muslim Brotherhood has used, but many other groups sort of conspicuously haven't been using, including, I should say, officials in the U.S. government. Why is that?
That term has a lot of implications for Egypt in terms of money, is what it comes down to, especially when you're talking about the United States, because the United States gives about $1.5 billion in military aid to Egypt every year, and one of the conditions of that aid is that you cannot have a military coup. And if there's a military coup, that aid is definitely on the line. And so the military leadership here, as well as the opposition groups supporting this transitional government, are being very emphatic that this is not a coup.
There were plenty of reasons why Mohamed Morsi's opponents wanted him out of office. How many of those reasons, Kimberly, were economic reasons?
A lot of them. I mean, if you're talking about the political opponents, they probably wanted him out of the office more for political reasons. But if you're talking about the people who were actually down in the streets demonstrating, a lot of them were listing economic reasons. Rising unemployment, rising food prices, gas shortages and fuel shortages in terms of like cooking fuel and diesel fuel and other things like that, as well as power outages and a general lack of knowledge of what's coming next for the country. Additionally, there's been a real problem with the security situation here.
You're there at a coffee shop in Cairo, and I just wonder the extent to which everyday life continues for folks there in Cairo. I mean, I hope this isn't a stupid question, but are people out shopping? Are people going to the banks?
Yes, I mean, today is definitely in stark contrast to the same street the day before yesterday, when there were hardly any businesses open, people were not out and about, they were hunkering down, getting ready for these protests, whereas today you definitely see people out socializing, going to the bank, going to the grocery store. Here at this coffee shop, guys are playing backgammon and smoking shisha while they're watching soap operas on TV. I see families out here as well, and it's a very laid-back atmosphere, and it's almost like any other day.
Egypt now has an interim president. I wonder just, you know, what sense do you have of what might be next?
It's really hard to predict what's coming next because it's hard to predict what this interim government is going to do. They've got a lot of issues to deal with, especially when it comes to Egypt's economy. They have to deal with a rising budget deficit, falling currency reserves. There's this ongoing negotiation with the IMF over a $4.8 billion loan that the previous government was not able to seal the deal on. And people are getting impatient. And, you know, there's this sense that people may give it some time, but it's not clear how much.
Kimberly Adams, a reporter based in Egypt, she joined us from Cairo. Thank you, Kimberly.
Thanks for having me.
Kimberly has shared a few pages from her reporter's notebook with us. You can read them on our website. That's at marketplace.org. Among those watching what's unfolding in Egypt are American companies. Whether they're selling goods to the 85 million people who live in Egypt or they're investing in the country's stocks and bonds, U.S. executives know Egyptian politics can affect business, as Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports.
It's always a wild ride investing in emerging markets. That's even more true in Egypt. U.S. companies there expect high risk and quick changes.
I think a lot of American firms were, by and large, prepared for what happened. They shouldn't have been caught by surprise.
That's Jeff Porter of North Africa Risk Consulting, an advisor to businesses working in Egypt. Investors hate uncertainty, but they're not sad to see Mohamed Morsi go. The business community felt he further botched a struggling economy.
The coup may actually be good for investment because there was a real tremendous amount of dissatisfaction with Morsi's leadership.
The thinking for many American investors is Egypt's economy can't get any worse and maybe it'll improve. Mohamed Darwaza with Medley Global Advisors thinks American firms will stay in Egypt. They can find lots of customers in its young population and substantial middle class.
There's still a huge U.S. corporations present in Egypt, and I expect them to remain there. And I don't think what has transpired in the past 48 hours or so will really impact that.
Those working to bring more American business to Egypt are trying to ease fears by pointing to what the country could be after political unrest settles. Hisham Fahami is CEO of the American Chamber of Commerce in Egypt.
In the next week or so, there'll be a lot of hesitancy, but I think in the long run, and as before, Egypt has fantastic potential.
But still, plenty of potential risk. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
U.S. markets were closed today for the 4th of July holiday. Details on the foreign markets when we do the numbers. It's Independence Day, the 4th of July, a day on which we celebrate American history and some core values: freedom of speech, freedom of religion, liberty, equality, just to name a few. Now, if you think about it, these are also what marketers call brand values. We promote and sell America, the brand, with our movies and music, with our technology, and also through our leadership roles in international institutions, the World Bank, the G8, and the UN. On this, the 237th year of our independence, we asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to check up on Brand USA.
This is Marketplace, so I'm going to go right to our brand as a global economic power here. And we'll have some sound effects. That's for great brand management, or a Bronx cheer for we're not doing so hot. Now, remember how S&P downgraded the U.S. credit rating in 2011 for poor fiscal management?
We were one of the few AAA countries, and then we weren't.
Economist John Canali at LPL Financial says for Brand USA, that was a definite but since then,
the economy's chugging along at 2%, not great, but I think it's a lot better than people would have thought. A year ago, our budget deficit is getting better. We are creating some jobs.
Sending stocks soaring and global investors flocking to U.S. treasuries and dollars.
You would have to say the brand is getting stronger.
Political economist Stan Collender says we're certainly doing better than the competition, Europe and China. But he says Brand USA has one big stain on it, political paralysis on budgets and deficits.
It's a little bit like all the officers of a corporation that are still squabbling, and stockholders are wondering whether they're ever going to be able to make decisions.
I asked marketing expert Cindy Gallup what she thinks America's core brand is.
This is a nation that more than any other stands for freedom. Freedom to build the life you want, you know, live the American dream.
Gallup says the world knows this brand through the revolutionary tech companies that they connect with every day, Google, Facebook. But we may be doing damage with our digital spying and surveillance, earning a big right now for Tech Brand USA. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
What is the American brand? Tweet us at David Gura at Marketplace APM. And if you've got any characters left, tell us how you think the American brand is doing. Yes, today is about history and about celebrating the birth of the U.S., but let's be honest here. For a lot of us, the 4th of July is also about grilling, maybe cracking open a couple of cold ones. Well, if you're trying to economize by throwing back a cheaper brew, odds are you're not saving as much as you think you are. Marketplace's Sarah McCammon looks at the rising price of cheap beer.
It's no secret that Pabst Blue Ribbon has been popular with hipsters for several years. But now that trendiness seems to be showing up in the price. James Wilson is an owner and bartender at The Gas Lamp in Des Moines, Iowa. Wilson's customers go through about 150 PBR Tallboy cans each week at $3.50 a piece.
I think people really like to hold on to the can. It's like an accessory.
Nationwide, PBR drinkers are paying more at many restaurants, bars, and nightclubs. A recent survey by the research firm Restaurant Sciences found double-digit price increases for Pabst. Compare that to growth of less than 2% for craft beers. But how much can the price of cheap beer go up before you might as well switch to a high-end microbrew?
I think it probably depends on what they're doing with their other brands.
Eric Shepard is executive editor at Beer Marketers Insights.
Can they go 50 cents? Can they go 75? Can they go a buck?
I put the question to patrons of The Lift, a bar in downtown Des Moines with a PBR sign on the wall. 27-year-old Liz Deakling of Ankeny, Iowa, says she usually pays $3 or $4 per drink.
Like, how much do you think you would pay? Like, what's your limit?
Not any more than $4 or $5. Not, I mean, that's pretty steep right there.
After that, she says she'd probably find a cheaper option. 31-year-old David Huckleberry says he recently saw PBR for $8 at an airport bar.
I refuse to pay that, so I'd say probably $4 or $5.
Do you think you'd pay $4 or $5 at your corner bar for that?
Yeah, I would, definitely.
And Huckleberry says even with higher prices, he wouldn't necessarily switch to a heavy craft beer. He says sometimes you want something lighter that you can drink a few at a time. I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
Television drama was reborn in the late 90s, and you could say it came of age in the last decade. HBO led the way, and other cable networks have followed suit. On these channels, at least, high ratings are no longer the only thing executives care about. They've given writers like David Chase and David Simon the time and the money to create stories critics call novelistic. Journalist Brett Martin says that today, TV is the place we turn to for big, complicated stories. Martin's the author of a new book about what he calls television's third golden age, an age, he argues, that's ongoing. The book is Difficult Men, behind the scenes of a creative revolution from The Sopranos and The Wire to Mad Men and Breaking Bad. Brett Martin, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So this is a book about a golden age of television, a golden age that really starts with The Sopranos on HBO. And that's an era that owes a great deal to a man who died a couple of weeks ago now. That's James Gandolfini, the actor who played Tony Soprano.
Sure. I think we've had a chance to revisit the beginnings of this era that I'm talking about. To me, it's impossible to overestimate the degree to which The Sopranos began this revolution. And I'd say that it's become clear that it's very hard to overestimate the degree to which James Gandolfini's role in The Sopranos made that possible.
Yeah, the Sopranos was something different. I just wonder, how did that new kind of drama come about?
Well, you had a confluence of events all leading to one place, which was that the creation of a television in which the one god of television, which had always been ratings, no longer mattered. And so you had huge proliferation of cable channels. You had televisions that were beautiful to watch. You had technology like the DVR, or at that time DVDs, that allowed serialization to take place. You could catch up with a story that was going on and on and on. And for all those reasons, suddenly there were places like originally HBO and then other networks that followed that recognized that quality and identity might be more important than numbers.
So a lot of credit goes to HBO, a channel that for a long time had just been airing movies, full-length movies made in Hollywood. What prompted them to look at the TV show as something they wanted to put on their channel?
Well, I think presciently they looked ahead and said, this movie business isn't going to be very good for very long. There's a lot of other ways that movies come into people's homes, as we've seen. And how are we going to stay alive? How are we going to be something that people even know about? And the answer was creating original programming.
You have network executives that seem to give the people who are creating these shows an incredible amount of latitude, a lot of money, really, to be very creative. And I just wonder, did they make that money back? Are these shows at all profitable? Is HBO making money off these shows? Is AMC making money off of Mad Men?
You know, I can't answer definitively I have not seen the ledgers, and I don't know the actual numbers involved. I do know that it's incalculably valuable on some level. Whether Mad Men itself makes AMC money or not, AMC exists because of Mad Men and can do The Walking Dead, which is a huge hit because of Mad Men. You would not know what AMC was without it.
So HBO does a lot to create this genre, and other channels catch on. FX build shows that are kind of in the mold of what HBO did. We see that then with AMC, TNT. Why is it that the traditional networks, the broadcast networks, haven't changed how they go about creating dramas on their networks?
Well, they've tried, I think, and it's really hard to do with their economic model. Network gave it its best shot with a great show called Friday Night Lights, which never could survive. And I think NBC was valiant in trying to make it work, but it, you know, because it had the expectations of what a network show would do, it just could not survive. You still need too many viewers, and that's the key to these shows, is that you can do a show on cable and on HBO, there's value there that isn't directly tied to how many eyeballs you've got on the show.
Just lastly here, you don't put an end date on this golden age. Indeed, it seems like it continues. Many of these shows are still on the air. Do you think that the end is in sight? Do you think that this will continue for a while?
I liken it to a gas flame going on, which is that when it's first being lit, it's really, you know, bright and kind of spectacular. And you can see that in the first wave of shows at HBO, at the first wave at FX, at AMC, and so on. And then you can stay lit and burn solidly. But once you've had success, it's very hard to act as though you have no stakes anymore, which is sort of what the magic dust in this is. That's the bad news. The good news is that there's an ever-increasing and ever-expanding universe of channels, of places that will need to do this. And that imperative is going to pop up somewhere, and I believe that good work is going to come out of it.
Brett Martin, his new book is Difficult Men, Behind the Scenes of a Creative Revolution from The Sopranos and The Wire to Mad Men and Breaking Bad. Thanks, Brett.
Thank you so much.
Coming up.
How many wines have I tasted in the last several years just in preparation? 20,000.
Oh, it's a hard job, but someone's got to do it. A look at what may be the toughest test in the world. But first, let's do the numbers. Traders in the U.S. have the day off, of course, but markets were open for business elsewhere around the world. European indices in particular liked the news today that the Bank of England and the European Central Bank don't plan to raise interest rates anytime soon. The ECB's president, Mario Draghi, said they'd stay low for what he called an extended period. On that, the British FTSE shot up more than 3%. The French CAC 40 jumped almost the same amount. Trading was mixed in Asia. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for June. Actress Edie Falco of The Sopranos and Nurse Jackie fame turns 50. And don't think about all the barbecue and ice cream you're consuming today when I tell you about this. On July 5th, 1946, the bikini made its debut in a Paris fashion show. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Happy 4th of July.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. Spain is one of the countries that's been hardest hit by the ongoing economic crisis in the Eurozone. The Spanish economy has been in a recession for most of the last 4 years, and unemployment there nationwide is just over 27%. In the south of Spain, in Andalusia, unemployment is even higher. But a small town there, led by a maverick politician, claims to be bucking the trend. Guy Hedgeco reports.
Marinaleda's mayor, Juan Manuel Sánchez Gordillo, has been in power here since democracy returned to Spain in 1979. He says his old-fashioned brand of socialism is a way of pursuing utopia.
A utopia seeks to convert people's noblest dreams into reality, whether it's decent housing, a job, or good health care.
But right now, Spain is finding that hard to achieve. It's deep in recession and is trying to emerge from a financial crisis.
Banks are being rescued with public money, but people need to be rescued. What we do here is try and walk in the opposite direction.
Walking in the opposite direction means direct action, such as this raid last year, when members of Gordillo's labor union took trolleys full of food from a supermarket without paying. They then gave the produce to local charities. Such initiatives have earned this politician the nickname the Robin Hood Mayor. Andalusia has a jobless rate of 37%, but in Marinaleda it's much lower, in great part because of an agricultural cooperative that gives work to locals, such as Juan Prieto.
90% of people in Marinaleda live directly or indirectly off this project. There's a group of us that work here permanently, and then others also come here when there's work for them.
Meanwhile, the town's people can help build their own houses, making property much cheaper than in neighboring towns. But not everyone buys into the mayor's vision. Hipólito Aires Navarro is a local opposition politician who thinks his rival is too interventionist.
Utopia means an unrealized dream, which Marinaleda has been trying to achieve for 30 years. But the town will never achieve what the mayor calls utopia. We need more industry, but not industry that is managed by the mayor. It needs to be managed by businesses.
But as Spain's deepest economic crisis in living memory drags on, this small town looks set to keep swimming against the tide. In Marinaleda, Spain, I'm Guy Hedgeco for Marketplace.
When you go out for dinner, you may notice it's becoming more common to see suggested wine pairings on menus and maybe sommeliers on staff. Sommelier, or a somm for short, has wine expertise. He can tell you what wine goes best with your fish. He can suggest a good bottle for a special occasion. Sommelier will work with hotels and restaurants to coordinate what to buy. Well, this weekend, more than 70 somms will travel to Texas. They'll take what might be the hardest examination in the world for any profession. The pass rate is 8%. Members of that select group will become master sommeliers, a designation as rare as, I don't know, a bottle of 2000 Chateau Lafite Rothschild. Marketplace's Nancy Fargali reports.
This is Troy.
My name is Troy Smith. I'm the beverage manager at Montage Laguna Beach.
That's a luxury hotel in Southern California. Troy is 38. He wears a gray suit, crisp white shirt, gray patterned tie. And he's a search engine for the hotel's main wine cellar. Montage Laguna has roughly 20,000 bottles of wine, and Troy's palate is as sophisticated as a Wall Street algorithm.
Cabernet Sauvignon from Napa Valley. Really big, full, intense flavor, powerful kind of cassis and black plum.
Troy takes the master's test this month. It's an invite-only exam administered by the Court of Master Sommeliers. The first master's test was held in 1969, and there are only 133 master somms in the U.S., 133 in the last 44 years. Troy has worked his way up the certification ladder. He's at the advanced level, one step below master's.
How many wines have I tasted in the last several years? just in preparation, 20,000.
Troy works 60 hours a week. He studies 4 hours a day on his work days and 9 hours a day when he's off. See, this test doesn't come with sample questions.
You know, it changes every time, so you never really know. You never really are sure if you're overstudying or understudying.
Blame Shane Bjornholm for that. He's the exam director of the court. He says passing the exam can mean a salary jump on average from $65,000 a year to $95,000. But most folks have to take the test multiple times. Shane says you have to identify many types of wine.
Oh, we're really kind. Only a million.
He's kidding, but you do have to know a lot about wine history and theory. And then there's this. You walk into a room and there are 3 glasses of white wine and 3 reds. You have 25 minutes to figure out what exactly is in the glass. Grape variety, vintage, region. Think, is it an old world wine from France or a new world wine from Napa?
Well, it's not to look cool or to show off. It really is just to try to figure out what typical wines taste like and then from there be able to launch into which are the more valuable ones for the money you want to spend.
We're going to open up a bottle of pretty cheap Rhone wine from France.
That's Syrah. Jason Wise. He's a wine drinker and a filmmaker. His documentary called Somme followed 4 master candidates before the exam. The film came out recently.
The term sommelier is at the right place at the right time right now, where everybody's kind of conscious of where does my food come from? Where do my ingredients come from? And people are kind of starting to become more aware of food and of beverage.
So back to Troy, our studious master somm hopeful. He's on the patio of Montage Laguna Studio Restaurant with a recommendation.
Scallops actually go, this particular preparation with the morel mushrooms and ramps goes really, really nicely with an off-dry Riesling from Germany.
But he knows it's always up to the customer.
Go ahead and make whatever menu selections appeal to you. Give me an idea of what sort of wines you do or don't like and a particular price range that interests you, and we'll go from there.
On Troy's menu, passing the exam and then sharing a bottle of wine with his wife. Probably a Bordeaux, an old world wine from France. Deep purple in color with little hints of cedar and dried rose. I'm Nancy Fergali for Marketplace.
If you prefer wine over beer, cheap or otherwise, and maybe you're wondering what to pair with that bacon cheeseburger hot off the grill, well, Troy passed along some recommendations. Go to marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, well, 2 of them actually. First, because I'm in New York, the annual hot dog eating contest took place today on Coney Island. And with 10 grand on the line, defending champion Joey Chestnut ate 69 hot dogs, 7 more than he ate last year. The second final note, a final note, if you will, an ad agency has invented the talking window. Here's how it works. You fall asleep on the train, you're resting your weary head against the window, and thanks to what the company calls bone conduction technology, vibrations travel through your skull to your inner ear so it sounds like there's a voice inside your head beckoning you to buy something. How about that? Bone conduction technology. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. U.S. markets were closed today for the 4th of July holiday. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm David Gura. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.